You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Andre whao oso toku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday, everybody. I'm your host, Andre, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Joining me in the studio is producer Arno and Jack, sitting along too. Ewha kēnē, coming up on the show, I speak to Associate Professor Susan St. John about the 2023 budget and how it falls short in addressing family poverty, hardship and food insecurity. On the Green Desk, Jack Marshall talks to Tyre Laura from the Department of Conservation, University of Auckland, rather, about marine protected areas and fishing vessels. On the weekly catch-up with James Shaw, Amelia chats to the Green Party co-leader about the budget, the $140 million subsidy for New Zealand steel, and about the Green Party's candidate list ahead of the general election. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I speak to two Etu union representatives. Firstly, Joe Gallagher about the new funding to reduce carbon emissions at Glenbrook Steel Mill. And then Rachel McIntosh about Etu's view on the 2023-2024 budget.
Thank you for that, Arno. And producer Alex speaks to Pam Ford from Tataki Auckland Unlimited about the role the economic agency plays in the region. He aha o whakaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these stories. So get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or waia mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. Kawa e ware ware e a hei ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō he pākihere roki roki mā runga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM I rakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Today, Amelia chats to the Green Party co-leader about his announcement of a $140 million subsidy to NZ Steel to transition away from burning coal, as well as a reflection on last week's budget and the Green Party candidate list ahead of the general election in October this year. Here's that piece now.
On Sunday, you announced a $140 million subsidy for NZ Steel to transition away from burning coal. How significant is this deal and what effect will it have on our emissions?
Look, it's a massive deal. It's the biggest decarbonisation project in the history of New Zealand. And so that's awesome. What it does is it cuts the pollution that's coming out of the steel mill in half. That's 800,000 tonnes of CO2 that won't be going into the atmosphere every year once the plant's up and running. That's the equivalent of 300,000 cars or every car in Christchurch. So in that sense, it's massive, and it makes it, you know, it gets us sort of pointed in the right direction when it comes to our sort of 2030 and 2050 targets.
And there has been the idea swirling around that taxpayers are the ones footing the bill to subsidise this polluter. Is this true?
No, it's not. That's incorrect. So the money comes out of the revenue that we get through the emissions trading scheme. So actually, it's paid for by polluters themselves, which I think is pretty good, you know, that you've essentially got polluters paying for other polluters to decarbonise.
NZ Steel says that they wouldn't have installed an electric arc furnace without money from the government, even though the $140 million you gave them is equivalent to only about 5% of their yearly earnings. How is this not, as the National Party called it, corporate welfare?
Well, that 5% of earnings figure is their global numbers. They kind of treat the company in New Zealand, you know, New Zealand Steel has to be profitable in its own right, and it was only a few years ago that they were talking about shutting it down because it was underwater at that stage. And so the size of this plant, it's, you know, $300 million, which is considerable for the New Zealand Steel company to have invested in. They couldn't make that work and keep it profitable. And so if we hadn't gotten involved in this, then I guess one of two things would have happened, one of which was that they would have continued their operations using coal And that would have meant, you know, the current level of pollution would have continued for at least 10 years. And then the second thing is, I guess, long term, there's then a question about the viability of the operation in New Zealand, because, of course, as the carbon price increases, the price of coal gets higher and so on.
I guess the big concern that people have is really that companies like NZ Steel should be legislatively required to do something like this without the help of the government. How do you respond to these concerns?
Well, like I said, this was only possible because of the reforms that we made to the emissions trading scheme in our first term in government. That then generated sufficient revenue that we could recycle into decarbonisation projects. So I would say it's actually only because the government took action through the Zero Carbon Act and the emissions trading scheme reforms that they're doing anything at all. Otherwise, they would just continue churning out the kind of high-polluting coal-based steel that they've been doing so far.
Do you expect other big polluters to see this and try to get a slice of the pie? You know, can we expect more decarbonisation funding to other industries?
Well, I hope so. I think, you know, what we've signalled here is that when, given that we do have this pot of money that's paid for by polluters themselves, we do want to work with our largest polluters in the country to decarbonise as fast as we can. And the vast majority of New Zealanders tell us they're really concerned about climate change and they want the government to do more. So this helps us to speed up the rate at which we decarbonise the economy.
Moving on now, we had Budget Day last week. We saw $1.5 billion allocated to cutting greenhouse gases. Did the budget deliver for the climate in your view?
Well, you know, it won't surprise you to learn that I thought that the government could have gone a lot further and a lot faster than it did. There was a considerable diversion of resources into the cyclone recovery. And that's one of the great ironies, is that the more frequent storms and fires and droughts and floods that we are having as a result of climate change actually make it harder for us to get ahead of the problem because we're stuck in responding to these crises. So, you know, I'm making the argument at this election that with more Green MPs in Parliament and more Green ministers sitting on the Cabinet table, that we'll be able to prioritise climate action and the response to the effects of climate change more than we have been.
So if you were in charge, if this was a green budget, what would you have liked to have seen prioritised?
Well, broadly speaking, you know, further efforts on decarbonisation, particularly on making it easier for individual households to kind of participate. So, you know, I'll give you an example. We know that solar energy is the cheapest form of energy ever created by the human race. So, you know, helping people to put solar panels on the roofs and to switch over, you know, if you've got like gas hot water or gas hob or things like that, which are based on fossil fuels and are getting more expensive to run over time, that would both help to decarbonise the economy, it would help to lower household bills, and it would also make us more resilient in the face of the kind of storms that we've got, because when the power lines get knocked down, those houses have their own source of power. So those kinds of initiatives, I think, are where we need to get to next in the fight against climate change.
And finally, the Green Party list was released a few days back. Are you happy with how things have turned out after it went to party members?
Yeah, I'm delighted. I think our members have given us a great list of really interesting, diverse, hardworking, and talented candidates, and I'm really pleased with that. I think there are some, you know, you've got our kind of existing and experienced MPs who are returning, and then there's some really great people who are coming forward as well.
Do you think this list will give the Greens the boost that it needs this election?
I think it's part of it. I mean, we have to. You know, it is about having really good people, and we need to make sure that voters see that we have got a really talented lineup and that we'll make a really good contribution to Parliament and to the next government. But also, we do need to set out our stall in terms of ensuring that we are delivering on what it is that we're here to do, which is around, you know, much stronger, much more urgent scale climate action, protecting our Indigenous wildlife and wildernesses, what remains of those, and to ending poverty in Aotearoa, which frankly no one but the Greens is committed to doing.
That was Amelia Sullivan speaking to Green Party co-leader James Shaw.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire. The government has indicated The Wire.
Etu union members working for the New Zealand Steel Mill in Glenbrook have welcomed the government's offer to contribute funding for new electric furnaces to halve coal use at the site. The $140 million investment will require upskilling for workers to use. I spoke with Joe Gallagher of Etu about the challenges involved in the transition, the benefits, and what workers would need to do. I started by asking for an overview of Etu union.
Etu is the largest private sector union in New Zealand. We are involved in the aged care sector, hospitals, obviously heavy industry like New Zealand Steel, all the major electrical companies in New Zealand, telecommunications, aviation. We look after the flight attendants. So we are a pretty comprehensive union.
What does the funding of up to $140 million to reduce carbon emissions at Glenbrook mean for the environment?
Oh, look, I think it signals a significant reduction in emissions and a less reliance on coal, and that's got to be a good thing for the environment.
What does Glenbrook plan to spend the $140 million on?
Look, they're going to install an electric blast furnace. And obviously that'll be powered by electricity, and that will mean there'll be less reliance on coal, and it secures the future of the mill for at least another 20 years, which is good for the community and the workforce.
Some of the steel produced will be from recycled sources. How will this affect overall production?
Look, I think, they run a pretty comprehensive system out there. I don't think it will affect the overall production. They're a pretty experienced outfit. They've been around since the 1960s, and I think they'll just blend it in. They've got good planning processes in place in New Zealand Steel to deal with this type of stuff.
How will it be ensured that all workers will keep their jobs?
Look, we're going to engage with New Zealand Steel, as we have with other industries, around creating a just transition process that allows us to ensure that the workers are potentially retrained or redeployed into other roles. We think this could be a blueprint for industry in New Zealand, as we continue to transition away from using fossil fuels.
What does a just transition for workers mean?
It means that you have a fully comprehensive process where you engage the workforce. You look to tailor individual programs for each worker and, work out what their needs are, whether it's retraining, redeployment, or potentially support around financial planning for retirement. So you create a suite of options that allow you to work through it, and that's why we call it a just transition as opposed to a consultation process where they just come in and tell you what's going to happen and you either lose your job or you don't. This is a much more in-depth process, and we've used it at New Zealand Post, and the results have been pretty pleasing and pretty positive.
Will the funding for that program fall under the $140 million?
Oh, look, I think the $140 million is going to be used for the installation of the electric blast furnace. I think this will be just a normal cost of doing business, but there's also a lot of support from different government agencies around retraining and the like. So we just need to sit down, put together a comprehensive plan, and then work out what agencies we need to involve as part of that process.
You mentioned New Zealand Post went through a similar just transition process. How will the transition here be a blueprint for other businesses who wish to go down a similar route in reducing carbon emissions by changing their processes?
Well, look, I think that, in New Zealand, we are really just at the beginning of this transition away from the reliance on fossil fuels. I think it's important to have put together an agreement that sets out all the things you need to think about and all the things you need to do and all the agencies you need to engage with. And, that's not easy depending on the size and scale of your company. And if we can create a blueprint and some tools and some learnings that we can share with other industries, then that's what we should all be trying to achieve.
Is there anything else Glenbrook will need to keep in mind to make the transition a smooth one?
Look, I think we're all on the right track, but I think that they'll need to keep in mind that this is actually, you know, really critical for the Franklin community and for the workforce, and we need to ensure that it goes as smoothly and easily as it can possibly go.
That was Etu Union Representative Joe Gallagher on the upgrade at the New Zealand Steel Mill in Glenbrook. We'll be right back after this short break.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
Hey, you're right. Okay, what about treasure trunks and six?
Chests.
They said you were good. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Tico Beats with Juliana Sion, Dylan Kalev, and guests with support from Bobby Brazuka.
And tomorrow,
Comedy Night with Corey Gonzalez-McCure and friends.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
SJD, three letters, one man, a band, and now free tickets.
Sorry, I didn't get that. You repeat your order, please.
You heard right, B-card holders. SJD is celebrating his striking new album, Sweetheart, live at the Hollywood Avondale, and we're giving away tickets to the show all this week on BFM Drive.
Wake up from your beautiful haze.
95 BFM presents SJD, Sweetheart Album Release Show, Friday, June 30 at the Hollywood Avondale. Tickets from banishedmusic.com.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Could you tell us what Te Taki Auckland Unlimited is responsible for at Auckland Council?
So Te Taki Auckland Unlimited is the economic and cultural agency for the region. And the area that I look after is that economic development side of the business. And what we do in there is do what economic development agencies do across the world, which is really make the place a great city for people to work. So driving the creation of quality jobs, a place to invest, so attracting investors, a place for people to visit, so our tourism promotion work, and then ensuring our Aucklanders have the skills and training that they need, that we develop the sectors that are important for the region. And why it's really important to have an active economic development agency for this region is that we have a very diverse population. We have quite...
Just to provide a little bit of context behind the interview, Alex Bonham spoke to Auckland Council's Economic Development and Regional Facilities Arm, Te Taki Auckland Unlimited, to talk about an announcement they had about 200 full-time roles being cut after the mayor is preparing to fulfil the budget deficit. So Alex spoke to Pam Ford of Te Taki Auckland Unlimited about what that will mean for Auckland. Here's that interview continued.
A broad geographic region. If we look at our people, we have a very young population relative to other cities, and 40% of our young people are Māori or Pacifica. What we do is really look at where is the need and where can we make sure that we can help all Aucklanders have economic well-being and make this place a great place to live and then visit.
Can you give us some examples on what you are doing on that social justice front?
We know that in South Auckland and West Auckland, they are areas that have lower prosperity than the rest of the region. Right now, we're looking at how we can develop a creative precinct in West based around Henderson that would, in time, this is a long-term project, a lot of our work is unseen because it does take years and years. And so we're looking at how we can leverage off the fact that we've got the Auckland Film Studios there, we've got some big gaming companies, we've got a lot of arts and culture, a lot of support companies for the film sector, and how you could bring those together, develop the place so that it attracts more investment, it attracts the right training and education that you could base in that area, and then grow businesses so that we can have a more thriving West Auckland? Because at the moment, we know through our data that more than any part of the rest of the region, West Aucklanders have to move and travel out of West Auckland to their jobs. And it's much better if people can be working close to where they live. It just improves their life, their well-being. You don't want to be sitting in traffic all your time. Similarly, we support in Manukau, Grid Manukau, which is a startup creative space for people in the creative industries and startup businesses. And that's grown out of the work that we've done in the city centre and Wynyard Quarter. So creating those networks of convening and connecting people and businesses and community is really the heart of what economic development is, and certainly supporting people where we think we can improve their economic well-being is really important.
Climate change offers lots of challenges, but also opportunities. What is Te Tāke Auckland Unlimited doing to help us transition to a world where climate change is happening and we need to do things differently?
You're right, climate change is extremely important, and we've all seen that playing out this year, haven't we, in Auckland? So we have a climate change team, which is in my economic development area. We are doing a number of projects. One very exciting is Climate Connect Aotearoa. There's a website which connects people who want to find out more about how we can accelerate our response to climate change in this region. It gives information. And then the other important part of Climate Connect Aotearoa is the practical side, where we're focusing on the four areas where there are most emissions in Auckland, and that is in the energy sector, transport, food and built environment. And there are what we call challenges, where groups of people come together and they tackle a challenge in one of those areas to try and come up with solutions that will help us accelerate our response to climate change. We also work with the tourism sector to help the industries, the businesses within that sector adapt and become more resilient, and looking at working with the screen sector on their emissions in the climate space. And then there's also our own work on our facilities within Te Tāke, the zoo, the art gallery, our stadiums and our venues. So work across the emissions side, but also how we adapt. Really important team and a huge amount of work.
There's just been an announcement that 200 jobs have got to go. Do you have any idea of what part of your portfolio of work is likely to be most impacted?
Well, that announcement was just yesterday, so we're working through what that will mean for the teams. And obviously we're working to the letter of expectation that we receive each year from the mayor. So that will be worked through over the next month.
If Auckland Council did not have an economic development agency, what might the impact be on the future of Auckland?
Well, cities all and regions across the world have economic development agencies. So, and their role is really to look at the future of the area and plan out and put in place programs that ensure that we continue to have quality jobs, that we're working in the sectors of the future. That's why we focus on technology, on advanced manufacturing, on ensuring that we provide programs for our young people, for our Māori and Pacifica, because they are the future. So, you know, of course, I would say this because it's the area in which I work and have done for some time. It is part of the fabric of a city to have an economic development agency.
That was Pam Ford talking to Alex about the role of Auckland's economic development agency, Te Tāke Auckland Unlimited, in securing Auckland's economic future.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Etu union members span many industries. With the release of the annual budget, they have taken a mostly positive view on the government's allocation of funding. I spoke with Rachel McIntosh, Etu union representative, about the budget. I started by asking what Etu's view is on the cheaper childcare and how it would affect New Zealanders and Etu union members.
Cheaper childcare makes it easier for working families to live a decent life. It is one of the outgoing costs for a lot of people in this country. and just making that easier and recognising the value of early childhood education and enabling people to go out and work and not have to spend all their wages on childcare will make a huge difference to a lot of people.
I guess the same could be said for reduced public transport fares for children and young people.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. All those things which are like common, they're common goods, you know, really, like transport, education, housing, so more investment in housing as well. All those things just make life easier for people.
Are bus drivers members of the union?
No, they're members of First Union, a sister union to us. But improving the conditions for bus drivers is also, it's really going to help.
How will improvements in DHB funding affect Air 2 union members, particularly those in aged care and community support?
Yeah, we are really looking to have that money that is being invested into Whatuora and in health to be put towards the lowest paid workers in the sector, which tend to be our members, and that is aged care workers, support workers, and also in the hospitals, orderlies and catering staff and cleaners.
On a bit of a side tangent, how will removing prescription costs affect big pharmacies that have already been offering free prescriptions and for smaller pharmacies that have been struggling to match this?
Well, it will help the smaller pharmacies and, you know, big corporates, they have their own business plan. But mostly what we're interested in the prescription charges is again, the effect for people, and we know that thousands of people in this country don't collect their prescriptions because of that and the barrier of that cost. So removing that is, you know, that's really positive.
Do you think that the government has made the right move in removing prescription costs for everyone, or should it have been for community cardholders only?
Universal application of services is a really positive thing. Overall, it reduces inequality. It makes things simple. And countries where there are universal benefits tend to have less inequality, and so we support that.
What infrastructure improvements have been committed that you are interested in seeing the results of?
The infrastructure improvements, so the transport infrastructure, that's really vital for this country. And so that will, you know, improved public transport infrastructure also makes it easier for working people, makes it a viable option for people, which is also good for the climate.
Finally, what is your overall view on the budget? Any major pros and cons or differences you'd like to have seen?
Overall, we think it's a good budget. It's positive. It supports people most in need, so that's young people, families with young children. And it also sets us up for the future. We particularly like the extension of the apprenticeship scheme. That's really positive to enable people to get into work, into decent work with good conditions and decent pay. So that's fantastic. Of course, we always would like more. But overall, we think this is a good budget.
That was Rachel McIntosh, Air 2 union representative on the government budget.
This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
So we all know that ocean ecosystems are under threat. Too much fishing, too many boats. But marine protected areas have been shown as an effective tool that increase both fish populations and their size. But little research has been done to investigate how those protected areas actually deter or perhaps attract commercial fishing vessels. In steps Ty Lawyer. He's a researcher who studied in Berkeley, California. And thanks to COVID, or unfortunately for him, we got him to study statistics here at Auckland University. And while he was here, Ty produced some fantastic research on marine protected areas in New Zealand. Now, you may not be surprised to hear this, but When an area gets marine protection, fishing vessels flock to the area and fish around it as much as they can. Why? They think there's more fish there? Well, the answer's actually a bit more complicated because of science. To explain more, here's Ty.
Yeah, so what we found is that despite decreases in fishable area caused by the implementation of these protected areas, total catch sharply increased following protection across all five study sites, and that this was mirrored by a similar jump in the number of trawl events that occurred.
So basically, once these areas are set up, trawlers and fishing vessels come in because the areas around them are basically full of fish.
Well, not necessarily. So the idea behind the study is pretty straightforward. It's that the creation of a protected area is purely legislative, so it should have no immediate impact on fish populations. Any benefits in terms of increased fish populations we would expect to occur gradually and over a period of years, but that's not what we found. We found sharp increases in both total catch, the number of vessels, and the number of trawls occurring. And these jumps were quite stark in some cases, where for the Diamond Head close seamount area, the number of trawls per vessel increased by nearly 400% after protection.
So I think I totally almost came at this from the wrong angle, thinking that marine protected areas made more fish, so fishing vessels came around the outsides. But it's actually, you're saying the fact these areas were made almost attracted fishing vessels to the area. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's basically what our findings sort of point to. So just as an overview, spillover refers to the net export of fish biomass from within a protected area's boundaries to the outside. And as I mentioned before, this we would expect to occur gradually over a period of years. And yet we found these sharp increases, which point to the fact that this couldn't be caused or is highly unlikely to be caused by the number of fish spilling out from within the boundaries. And sort of some more evidence towards that is that the areas that were protected had very little fishing activity occurring within them before protection. The maximum was 4% of trawls at the Auckland Islands Marine Reserve occurred within the area that were protected, the other 96% being in the surrounding area.
Oh, so this is actually kind of a horrible, the law of unintended consequences, where people are actually fishing more around areas because they're becoming protected.
Yeah, so that's sort of what we're thinking, is that upon hearing the news that a protected area has been implemented, fishers flock to the sort of surrounding area and increase their effort. So we see more vessels in the area as well as a higher number of trawls per vessel in most of these study sites. But we don't know if this is necessarily a negative thing. This paper is sort of one of the first to study this in New Zealand and shows that we need to sort of have more research in this sphere.
I know it didn't kind of really explore it in the article that you wrote, but what do you think some of the solutions could be to stopping, marine protected areas becoming just like a honey trap for commercial fisheries? Because I know it's probably not your area of expertise, but did you have any ideas?
Yeah, so this is sort of beyond the scope of the paper, but I think we do need to have more research into the drivers of fishing behavior and sort of open up this dialogue. And something interesting in the paper as well is in most of these study sites, we see a sharp increase in catch and in the number of trawl events, but this sort of gradually decreases after a couple of fishing seasons. So I think my sort of interpretation of it is that fishers flock to the area thinking that these areas have been protected because they're biologically productive, and then sort of realize that it's not really any different to where they were fishing before and gradually leave the area. Yeah, so I think we just need a better understanding of sort of why this phenomenon is occurring and open up this dialogue.
Yeah, so I guess it's probably best. Marine protected areas aren't really the problem. It's just more communication with fishing vessels and such is probably a better way to go around it. Because I imagine then, after a couple of years, once they've stopped flocking to the area, the protected area can actually rejuvenate its population and become like a better served conservation area.
Yeah, and I think it sort of ties in nicely with your talk with the person from DOC last week about the remote sensing techniques, because these offshore marine protected areas that I looked at were hundreds of kilometers offshore. You know, they're sort of out of sight, out of mind. It's hard to monitor what's going on around them without it being prohibitively expensive. And so, yeah, we need to understand whether this phenomenon that we observed actually has a negative impact on the surrounding area and within the protected areas themselves. One of the most interesting things that we found was what we observed at the Auckland Islands Marine Mammal Sanctuary and Marine Reserve. So in 1993, the Marine Mammal Sanctuary was implemented, which in everything but name was a marine reserve, essentially banning any kind of fishing going on. And then 10 years later, it was made into a full marine reserve. The only difference being it banned recreational fishing, which, since the Auckland Islands are very far offshore, likely didn't have a large impact. And so despite essentially not changing, when the marine reserve was implemented in 2003, we observed the same sharp jump in total catch and the number of trawl events. So it sort of gives further evidence that this wasn't caused by spillover. It's a change in fishing behavior.
That was Tai Loa, a researcher studying marine protected areas in New Zealand. Nga mihi.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was The Green Desk with Jack Marshall. You're on the wire on 95 BFM. We'll be right back after this short break.
BFM. Sleaf of Mods, the power station. 95 BFM presents for the first time in New Zealand since their legendary sold-out debut in 2019. Sleaf of Mods. Brutal, foul-mouthed, angry, killer funny and utterly brilliant. This is... Sleaford Mods, the power station, Saturday the 27th of May.
With special guests Big Scout. New tickets just released for this Friday show. And grab the final tickets for this Saturday show now.
Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.
Ugh, I'm so hungry, I could eat a plane.
Let's go to Motet.
Oh, that's a great idea.
The Motet Food Truck Roundup is back. They've teamed up with Auckland Food Truck Collective for three scrumptious nights in May. There's something for everyone. Smooth tunes by Māori Hi-Fi and lots of cosy spots to settle into. The Motet Food Truck Roundup, May 25th to the 27th, 6 to 9pm. Entry is free and under 16s must be accompanied by an adult. For more info, visit motet.nz.
My children of the night, can you smell that? That's the scent of a fresh new band!
95BFM's Fancy New Band 2023.
Presented by Byron Bay Brewery. Pina Colada and Gin Spritz Sparkling Cocktails.
Whammy Bar and Backroom, Saturday, May 27, with thanks to Under the Radar.
Featuring artists fresher and tastier than the board of a orange.
Sabrina's Lamb, Elliot and Vincent, Ballot Box, Yaya, Chris RL, Chase Woods, DJ Blush.mp3,
and a good old dose of BFM karaoke to end the night.
Fancy New Band 2023, Whammy Bar and Backroom.
Saturday, May 27th, Koha entry.
Do you, 95BFM, take New Zealand Music to be your lawfully wedded partner?
I do!
And do you, New Zealand Music, take 95BFM to be your lawfully wedded partner?
I do!
This is the happiest day of my life.
It's New Zealand Music Month on 95BFM.
And to show how much we love Kiwi music, we are only playing local tunes on 95BFM all week. Show our local musicians some aroha this New Zealand Music Month and tune into 95BFM.
Hello. But in terms
terms of comparing it to the current prison system, though, would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, how do you improve a piece of shit?
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. We'd love to hear your thoughts on any of the stories that have been on so far. So text in on 5395 or Why Maidane. Give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. The 2023 budget aimed to do many things, including easing pressure on inflation and assisting vulnerable communities with rising costs. Susan St. John, Honorary Associate Professor in the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Auckland and spokesperson to the Child Poverty Action Group, says that the government needs to do more to lift children out of poverty, address food insecurity, and support those in hardship. Here's our analysis and commentary on the 2023 budget. So, Susan, could you tell me just a little bit about what your initial reactions are or were to the 2023 budget last week?
I saw a lot of good things, but I didn't see the elephant in the room, which is the incredible poverty that's developing in New Zealand. I didn't see that mentioned. So, yes, there were a couple of good initiatives, and it's really good that transport will be a bit cheaper. And good that the prescription charges have gone. They will make a difference to the budgets of some people. But we know that thousands and thousands of families do not have enough money to feed their children. After they paid their rent and their electricity and their other absolute essentials, they find they've got a gap. They've either got to go to a food bank or they've got to go to WINS and argue for a grant, or they've got to borrow. And none of those things are good for our society.
No increases in benefit support since the inflation adjustment, I think it was of 7.2% for beneficiaries earlier in the year. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the whole benefit system needs a really big shake-up. For example, a couple should not get less than two single people living together. Couples with children are incredibly poor if they're only living off a benefit. They just do not have enough to survive. So removing some of the anomalies within the benefit system was imperative. But also what we're seeing in the benefit system is a much greater reliance on top-up supplements that are often difficult to get. Accommodation supplement is one, but temporary additional support, recoverable grants, things like that that people get themselves into, because their benefits, their core benefits, are just not enough.
You said in an interview with RNZ that increasing benefit thresholds and folding the in-work tax credit into the family tax credit into one would lift children out of poverty. Could you speak more about how this would work?
Well, one of the gaps in the budget was the failure to even mention working for families. Working for families is the major way in which we support low-income children. It's a very important program. And unfortunately, the inflation adjustments that we've had to working for families are just not enough. We've still got the anomaly that if you're on any benefit at all, even if you're working, you're not entitled to the full package for your children. So many of the poorest families are still missing out on that $72.50 a week. That would have been something I would have thought would have been an obvious win for the government if it was concerned about well-being and reducing child poverty. But the second thing was what you were mentioning, which was the threshold issue. So many families who are doing their best, they're working in low-paid work, they reach the threshold, $42,700, at which working for families starts to reduce. And it starts to reduce at a very rapid rate. So there were two things that should have been adjusted in this budget for that group. One is raising that threshold, probably up to about $52,000 or $53,000, and indexing it properly, and reducing the rate at which working for families reduces. So it's currently 27% for every extra dollar you lose, 27 cents of working for families. That should be back to 20.
The Auckland City Mission said in the lead-up to Budget Day that food insecurity needs to be addressed. With the cost of living crisis contributing to an all-time low in food donations to food banks across the country, what more does the government need to do to ensure food security and address food insecurity in our communities?
Well, it certainly wasn't talked about in the budget. And food banks are finding, as you said, that they don't have enough money to meet the need. So what does that mean in a country like New Zealand, which is a food-producing nation, and we've got families that are being turned away from food banks when they cannot feed their children? This is a serious crisis, and I'm afraid I didn't see anything about that in the budget.
I guess bread and butter budget, as termed by Chris Hipkins and Grant Robertson, or a breadcrumbs budget, this is something that could be interpreted upon. Do you think, as a spokesperson for Child Poverty Action, that you think that these groups need to consult and input more within the decision-making of monetary allocation to different services that the government provides? In order to lift children out of poverty and bring better outcomes for vulnerable families?
Well, we certainly need more voice out there to speak up for those children. But I would also have to say that many in the NGO sector have spent many, many, many hours consulting with this government, responding for its calls for submissions. We had an announced review of Working for Families 2 years ago. Many of us were involved with meeting on Zoom, sending in written submissions, talking it through. We've seen no formal response to that in terms of what the government intends to do. So to announce the review 2 years ago, to involve all that unpaid work from the NGO sector who are struggling already, not to have anything at all in the budget to even indicate that there might be something in the next few months, leads me to suspect that it's probably just going to be swept under the carpet until next year.
And I guess that is quite a big fear among all NGOs, especially since this is an election year. This tends to be quite the crucial time. And so do you feel optimistic, irrespective or actually relative to who gets elected in October? Do you feel optimistic or somewhat pessimistic for the 2024 budget?
Well, let's suppose that they do come up with their results from their review of Working for Families and they say some sensible things and it becomes an election football and then we get the other side who won't have a bar of it. Well, I don't know what kind of country we're going to be in. We needed some big changes to be embedded before the election. We don't have that opportunity now. I would have to say that our best hope is for Labor to get back in and for its supporters to have put so much pressure on that there's immediate major changes made. Because the longer you leave this problem, the harder it is to fix with a little bit of money. The longer we leave it, the more money it's going to cost and the more social costs we will experience.
That was Susan St. John speaking to me about the 2023 budget. She is a spokesperson for the Child Poverty Action Group and a honorary associate professor at the University of Auckland.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou I kōrero katoa, I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire, everybody. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Green Party co-leader James Shaw, Thai lawyer Joe Gallagher and Rachel McIntosh from Air 2, Pam Ford of Te Taki Auckland Unlimited, Susan St. John, spokesperson for the Child Poverty Action Group and honorary associate professor at the University of Auckland. And thanks to Arno and Alex for joining me in the studio today, and also Jack Marshall from the Green Desk. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. We'll have a few lineup of songs followed by The Wonderful with Bridge. So stay tuned. Thanks to everyone who's been listening. Have a great afternoon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.